Hi, this is The Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to was originally recorded back at DEF CON 1 in 1992 at the Sands Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Now, the Sands has since been blown up to make room for something new, but the speeches live on. All rights are reserved except for educational uses only. If you'd like more information about DEF CON, please contact us at dt@defcon.org or visit our website at www.defcon.org. Now, get ready to sit back and listen to a great speech, and I hope to see you at a future DEF CON. Woohoo!
I am the representative of the civil bar. I was a federal prosecutor for 3 years. I now work for a San Francisco law firm, and my clients include AT&T and Sega. But before people get upset, we don't represent AT&T against people like you. We represent only when there's a lot of money at stake. We represent AT&T in the telephone toll fraud cases when we fight with the people who have the PBX on their site. They say they're not responsible for certain millions of dollars of charges, for example, made to small towns in Bolivia. And we say that they are responsible, and we sue them, and we get the money, regardless of how the problem was generated or who generated it. I'm going to be talking about virtual reality and some of the legal issues that that come up with virtual reality. And I think you'll see that there are a lot of threads that have been talked about so far today that I'll be touching on. I'm not going to talk about copyright or any of the other interesting issues that have been come up here, but I'm going to be around through tomorrow morning. I'd be happy to chat with people about any of the issues that come up on the civil side. I help out the ESF. I'm one of their regional counsel in San Francisco, and so I've dealt with some of the First Amendment, Fourth Amendment search and seizure issues that you run into on the net. Various bulletin boards. I'm not going to talk about copyright. I'm not going to talk about search and seizure, any of the constitutional issues. I do have an article on First Amendment issues in cyberspace coming out in Virtual Reality magazine. Went to press yesterday. I don't know what that means. It's the one that comes out. It's much slower because it comes out on paper. And that'll come out perhaps within a month or so. It's published by the Meckler Corporation that does a lot of the virtual reality seminars. I'm going to be talking about virtual reality and moving into the civil aspects. There are a number of people here who have talked to you about some of the criminal issues that can come up. There are a lot of computer crimes. Most of them are very old-fashioned crimes that are simply accomplished with a computer. And there are a lot of new crimes which are accomplished with a computer that couldn't have been accomplished before, the erasure of data, for example. But the law has no problem at all making an analogy between erasing data and destroying property. And although a lot of time can be spent about, you know, what kind of a statute does this fit in and is this illegal or not, the fundamental rule, and you'll see this carry over into the civil law area, the fundamental rule is if somebody thinks they have been hurt by you, they will sue you and they will win. And it doesn't matter how advanced the legal system is or how knowledgeable the people are, the judges or the juries who sit and listen to these cases. Lawyers like myself are paid to make the facts fit into whatever the current law is. It doesn't matter. Absolutely doesn't matter in the slightest. We will fit it in, and we will win. Hopefully. Now, as the industry matures, we're moving now from an area in which the criminal law, constitutional law is of the greatest concern. We're also now moving into the area of civil law, where there's enough money to hire people like me to get involved. At that point, a whole other body of decision makers gets into the act and starts sniffing around and starts writing the rules. For example, electronic mail privacy and trade secrets theft and things like that. Those rules, as you've heard earlier today, are now going to get written in civil lawsuits where there are no police, no DAs, no federal nothing involved. Civil lawsuits, for example, Intel suing a programmer who used to work there, or Symantec and Borland suing each other over the theft of trade secrets, that kind of stuff. That's where the laws are going to get made. And that's when there's enough money at stake. And as most of you know, it is very easy to generate enough money at stake. You don't have to do very much to cause damage which some lawyer will value at enormous sums. You may think you've done something fairly trivial, but a lawyer has the ability to say, my God, that's millions of dollars here. Let's go for it, you know, put my kids through college. Now, let me talk about virtual reality a little bit as to how I define virtual reality. I've seen millions of incredibly boring disputes on the Internet as to what VR is and what cyberspace is and people flaming about this stuff. I'm going to move sort of past that, I think, a little bit and talk about a kind of virtual reality system which does not currently exist, but the technology for it is here, and it's just a question of cost and getting things small enough so that they fit on our bodies comfortably without our knowing about them. There are no theoretical problems at all, as far as I know, about the kind of virtual reality systems that I'm talking about. I'm talking about VR systems which are massively networked, they're broadband, interactive, immersive, computer-mediated experience. This is not flat-screen, Wolfstein 3D sort of stuff. This is not what I mean. I include data, including auto-visual displays, feedback, and other sensory inputs, which are a function of very complex systems. Those complex systems are made up of operating systems, layers of application software, including those that are running locally, and remote systems that are running, and remote databases, and programs resident on remote platforms. The new techniques which we expect to come forward, and which are currently exist, which again simply have to be developed or made cheap enough so that we can buy them, ordinary people can buy them. Already there are techniques for direct retinal imaging, which gives you the impression that something is there, just as a real object is there. We have VDT cursors which can be moved with brain waves. They've already done the experiments. It's a little slow. People, I suppose, have to concentrate very hard. But the fact that this has already been done tells me that techniques of amplification, selection, filtering, and things like that can be applied, and that can actually, brainwaves will actually can be used to control the real world. We also have surround systems, which are now becoming common. I mean, you read about them now in Time magazine. We all hate it when you see something in Time. Go do something else. But in Walnut Creek in California, we're going to be getting some systems that are coming out. You probably know about the Star Trek systems that are going to be coming out. We have BattleTech in certain areas. Everybody's interested in the Sega goggles. I've done a very long report for my client Sega on those goggles. They're very interesting, and they'll be hitting the shelves shortly at under $200 or around $200 a piece. And if you think the Mattel glove is sort of popular to play around with, these goggles I think will be even more interesting. Sega, as you know, also has the activator infrared system, lines of infrared beams that go around your body and respond to your bodily gestures. And in your imagination, if you just put together the Sega goggles, Sega activator systems, maybe a little brainwave control, you can see how VR systems, VR systems in the fairly near future could be extremely realistic, very, very useful. Now, I think the most interesting issues, let me tell you about some of the directions I think that VR is moving. I'm going to talk about VR in a technical way for a little while, and only at the end talk about some of the legal issues. If this was a group of lawyers, I would give talk about a site of S73rd, Fed 2nd, and so on, and tell you about this case versus that case. But I think it's more interesting to show to you the problems that even unintentionally arise out of complex systems, and VR systems, or future VR systems, being the most complex systems that are going to be available to the general public, are going to cause their own inherent problems, which are going to lead to lawsuits. That's my hope, anyhow. one of the directions that we're moving to is from single actor to multi-user. Right now, a lot of the VR systems are just interacting with a box. They're interacting with some software. You're wandering around inside of a molecule, for example, to see how the thing's put together, or maybe you're designing something, CAD-CAM sorts of systems. Those will always exist and are useful to some extent. But in terms of these systems getting hot, selling a lot, and therefore generating a lot of R&D dollars so that people will really make a terrific system out of it, it's the multi-user system that people are going to be interested in. We're moving from communicating simply with the CPU to an environment in which people from all over the world are going to be able to interact. And the current, all we've got right now are the MUDs, multi-user dimensions, or dungeons, depends how old you are, so what you want to call those things. Those give you a small idea of what it might be like. You add a VR interface to that, and you get a sense of how people, I think, would like to be able to interact. And that's what people want to do. Given the choice between communicating with a computer and communicating with other human beings, normal people will choose human beings. President company accepted. I don't know. But for example, if you look at the attraction of Falcon 3.0, I don't know how many of you have that. There's a lot of interest in having those things connected. People are screaming to Lucasfilms, which is about four blocks from where I live in San Rafael, to get interactive X-Wing moving. And Sierra Online system, the game system for Sierra Online, is really proving to be pretty popular. People are really enjoying that. And not because they can call in and play against the machine. You can do that in your living room or in your house. They're calling because they can communicate and chat with people from all over the world. And that's what we find so intriguing about the net, this immediate ability to talk to anybody, get into conversations with people in Switzerland or Australia. And it's that human interaction which really is so powerful and so driving. The bandwidth problems that are generated when you have millions of people wanting to do that on a wide basis can be solved to some extent by local databases. Technically, that's how Sierra Online works. You have a lot of information right there in your box, and you're able to reduce, for example, the way things look, the way things feel, and so on. And you're allowed, and that allows you to reduce the amount of information that actually has to travel across the wires. And I don't seriously think we're going to have a problem in getting enough information through the wires to generate real-time VR interactions. The other movement, the movement from single actor to multi-user, is duplicated also from the movement from what I call the exoskeleton of VR machinery to the elimination completely of the interface. We're moving from, you know, this image of this goggle-headed, sort of body-suited, multi-wired, sort of almost half-human, half-robot, to somebody who is able to dispense with all of that and looks perfectly normal while they're in a VR environment. And it is the desire and the wish to eliminate the user face, which is driving, I think, a lot of the VR development that we have going. You've heard, I've got a new acronym. Didn't think I should talk without a nice acronym. You've heard of Zero Insertion Force Sockets and, of course, GUI. I have ZUI, Z-U-I, which is the Zero User Interface. And I think that is what we want to do. We want to move to a technology where we can forget completely that the technology exists. This morning, one of our speakers talked about how screwdrivers have moved from perhaps something nifty and cool, and, you know, probably books were, if they had been able to create written books about how to use a screwdriver, like people write about books on DOS 6 or something. But, you know, people don't want to have to read that stuff or know it or even realize that it's there. People just want to put those blocks of wood together. And the computer user face is moving through, in the VR community, is moving in that direction. Zero user interface. We don't want to see it. We don't want to smell it. We don't want to face it. We want to think of the computers as dissolving. We want to take it for granted in the same way we take our environment for granted sometimes. For those who are green, that's the problem. We take our environment sometimes too much for granted. We don't see it's there. We don't see it disintegrating. And computers, I think, are going to be dissolving as well. When we talk about totally immersive VR, when we talk about sort of a la Gibson, you know, chips in the brain, that sort of thing, when we talk about other kinds of integration between mind and machine, what we're really getting at is zero user interface. We're talking about just destroying the technology on a daily basis to the extent we possibly can, so it no longer becomes an interest, an issue. Now, what is it for the environment to become real? You know, people think that this room is real. I mean, this is the first time I've ever been to Las Vegas. I don't think anything around here is real. Right across the street is a mirage. And why do you think they call it that? And this is bizarre stuff. Somebody from the 14th century walking down the strip last night, you know, at 11:30, they would not think this is real. They would be convinced that they were on some kind of a drug, that there was something horribly wrong going on. And somebody from the Stone Age, just walking down the street, sort of a normal street in Boston or San Francisco, I think would have the same feeling. Things get real after a while, is what happens. We adjust. We go on to other things. We go on to other issues. Things drop away, fade away into the background because we can only concentrate perhaps on a few things at once. We get used to things. There's a lot of, this is the story of a lot of technology, the zipper, cars, phones, where we no longer use them intentionally in a sense, but we use them almost by the by to get some other kind of work done. And, you know, on the telephone, I don't worry as to whether or not the voice that I'm listening to is real or not. I mean, it doesn't occur to me to think whether this is somebody's real voice. Of course, it's not. It's not coming out of their sound box. But I am perfectly comfortable in saying that this is a real person talking to me. And I don't mind that my money is electronically transferred. And I don't mind that my novel is, well, I guess I do mind my novel's only on the hard drive. I mean, I guess I would like it to be more widely distributed than that. But it really, really does, these things really do exist. The things that Mitch Kapor has talked about is his definition of cyberspace. It's where my money is, you know. That's a big chunk of cyberspace. But the point is that cyberspace in that sort of very loosey-goosey sense is perfectly real, and none of us have any question about it. We just get on with the rest of our lives. Now, later on, in a slightly different context, I'm going to talk about what I call, you know, what other people have talked about is the own suspension of disbelief, this ability that we have, which is part of VR's ability to convince us. But let me just note here that a real environment is just one that we know well. It's one that responds at such a speed and is sufficiently predictable that we ignore it and we just take it for granted. And it simply forms the background for a useful plan work. It disappears from our consciousness and we simply no longer question it. That's a perfectly reasonable definition of reality and it might even encompass Las Vegas after a while. Now, the interim conclusion, I am laying the groundwork here for problems and how problems get generated. But right now, let me just map out where I've gotten so far. We have a multi-user system with a zero-user interface, and we have real interactions with real people with real parts of the world. Now, you must believe that the world of courts and lawyers and judges are interested when real things happen in the real world, regardless of what their source is. Now, Murphy's Law, something can go wrong at will, and my law is that if something goes wrong, someone will get sued. Now, let me get to the next section here, virtual reality as affected by the law. And this is really an analysis of simply the complex systems that are presented by emerging VR technologies. Now, error will get generated by these complex systems. And it's basically going to be, I think, a function of basically four interrelated problems. Number one is a high complexity of the computer code that's at issue. Number two, the theoretical inability to debug any kind of a sophisticated program. Number three, that VR systems rely on interpolation and perhaps when they get very realistic on fuzzy logic. And fourthly, the extremely high speed of usefully used VR systems. First, let me talk about high complexity in computer code. Again, breaks down into four, but this is the last time I'm going to have four things breaking down into four things or anything like that. Complexity. Four problems with computer code. Number one, the software to be used in high-end VR systems and increasingly is going to be very complex. Complexity is a function of the size of programs, the multiple providers of software and hardware who are involved, multiple simultaneous users, and intentional programming in of chaotic behavior. First of all, new operating systems are going to be very, very big. And I heard numbers this morning which surprised me. I didn't. Somebody tossed around the word a billion? Who said a billion? Did you say a billion?
It's MBS, KIX, all of its associated utilities.
Jesus. Okay. Great. Much worse than I thought. Yeah. You know, Pink is going to be familiar with Pink. It's still in development. It probably is pretty much finished. But we can't have it. Is 3.5 million lines of code, maybe up to 5 million lines of code, maybe it'll get even bigger before it gets released, everything does. But to give you an idea of what the size of code is and the sorts of problems that get generated, start with an air traffic controller computer. It's about 130,000 lines of code. And things go wrong with air traffic controller computer systems all the time. I'm a pilot and I have suffered at the hands of these machines. Automated teller network, 6,000 lines of code. Telephone routers, 2 million. The B-2 bomber is 3.5 million lines of code, part of the systems in it. The Seawolf submarine combat computer is 3.6 million lines of code. And things go wrong with these systems all the time. And later on, I'll give you some examples from SRI's risk list. I'll also give you download that anonymously. So other things that can go wrong with fairly small, non-complex systems. So that's one problem. And if the operating systems of the future are going to be larger than that, the programs are going to mount simply as a function, I think, of the size of the code. Secondly, in terms of complexity, we have multiple entities. We've got software developers, publishers, telecommunications providers. We've got fiber optic people involved in that. We've got satellite providers, hardware platforms, and vendors. And no one is in charge. And, you know, this notion that someday somebody's going to be in charge and sort of tell us what the rules are and what to write for and all you have to do is, you know, figure out how Windows NT works or something like that, and you'll be fine. is ludicrous. You know, people are always fighting about the battle of the platforms. Those things will increasingly get worse. There's no reason to think they would get better. Thirdly, we have many simultaneous users and the expectation of immediate response. Call it buffer overflow. And I'll give you an example of how some people have been killed in hospitals as a result of just simply buffers overflowing, logical buffers overflowing. But the idea of many simultaneous users as well increases the level of complexity. Now, high complexity and unpredictability, I think, is also going to be sought out by the programmers, by the providers, to mimic real life. Objects must have many properties. And if you know anything about AutoCAD's CDK software, it's been released recently, properties of gravity, pressure, even all the different things that you might associate with an object in the real world can be associated with an object in a VR environment. The virtual reality's power lies in its wholly immersive kinesthetic front end, and importantly, that interface is a function of these many users. Now, a truly sophisticated environment will be complex. It will be theoretically unpredictable, that is chaotic, just as real complex systems exhibit rule-bound but chaotic behavior. And I suggest that it is that unpredictability and these open-ended sort of processes which are going to make the contribution to the feeling that you really are in a virtual world, that not everything is being programmed. That's part of the feeling that you want in a VR system. Now, current standalone computers, and by that I mean also ones that just send email back and forth to each other, are simple because they're basically uncoupled from the user except through the keyboard. They depend maybe on their electrical states, not much more. Gravity holds them down. There are not a whole lot of very complicated forces acting on these machines. But I think as we move to virtual reality systems, as the number of elements in the systems increase, as the number of semi-autonomous agents, that is human beings, increases, we will get that chaotic behavior. If anybody's here familiar with a little bit of chaos theory, and I don't mean Jurassic Park's little lovely introduction to it, which was really so clever, but at least it got the word out. A chaotic system can be generated with only three interacting independent systems. I mean, three pendulum or three magnets that are moving a piece of metal around will generate a chaotic system. So it doesn't take much to go over the edge. Unpredictability. The second sort of problem we're going to get that is going to generate interesting issues in the future and income for my law firm is theoretical inability to debug. There was a wonderful article in Scientific American about a year ago, and I cannot find the site. If somebody has it, please give it to me, that pointed out that it is for any sort of large, and these days anything, we're perfect as a large program these days. It's impossible to completely debug these systems. For the mathematicians, the issue is bound up with the halting halting problem. I've halted on that. Because the point being that you cannot tell in advance whether or not you have got all the bugs out of the system. You can't do it. That means that buggy systems are going to get released. There is a release from, there's a line here, I think, from Rays. It is for any sort of large, and these days anything, we're perfect as a large program these days. It's impossible to completely debug these systems. For the mathematicians, the issue is bound up with the halting problem. I've halted on that. Because the point being that you cannot tell in advance whether or not you have got all the bugs out of the system. You can't do it. That means that buggy systems are going to get released. There is a release from, there's a line here, I think, from Ray's handout. His quote, there's a quote here that says something like, a mentor once told me, there comes a time when you just have to ship it. And in the real world of real applications, stuff is going to get released. And sometimes it's going to be small bugs, they're going to get discovered once every 2,000 or 3,000 years. But that means that it could get discovered in the first 20 minutes that it's on your system. You know, currently we have, everybody knows what the current problems are just on a small system. The conflicts, the different kinds of DOSes, motherboards, applications, the enormous amount of time it can go in. You can spend days just sort of fiddling with your system and make it operate. I mean, I don't even mean efficiently. I mean, just operate. And this is very, very small stuff. People are involved in networks, and our larger administrators have even larger problems, and I do think it'll get worse. The third problem is interpolation. The synthetic appearance of a virtual reality system may not distinguish between what's hard data, what's real, in a sense, what the real points are, and what the interpolations are, the lines between the points, the shadings. You're going to have users making decisions in virtual context who will not know which aspect of their context is real data and which of it has simply been interpolated by the system that they're operating in. Now, we handle this kind of a problem all the time in real life, but in this current world that we're in right now, we can tell the difference between points and lines that connect points. We can usually tell the difference between interpolation of information and real information. I say that, you know, being optimistic. In point of fact, we really don't. There are a lot of people, most people, I think, are not very literate when it comes to numbers. I include myself in this. And mistakes and statistics and stuff are made all the time. People think things are facts when, in fact, somebody has misunderstood something or somebody has interpolated something. Consider a virtual world where the user flies through multicolored, multi-shaped objects, terrain which provides information at a virtual glance. For example, information on the performance of a corporation, stocks, and a lot of other data with a national global economy. And you're flying through this terrain and you're making a decision to invest or not to invest or what to do on the stock market. The system is up and running. I didn't make that up. That software is available to you now. Now, under these circumstances, the inability to distinguish between what is hard data in that flow that you're looking at and what the computer system has sort of generated to make it all look real and fill in all the gaps and make everything look comfy cozy, because we don't have any blank areas here, could be very difficult. You could easily make the wrong decision. In a successful virtual reality environment, we'll act as if we are in all of those places. Experiments have already shown that when one sense, for example, vision, is replaced by tactile feedback, for example, pressure on your back, pressure against the skin on your back, patterns of tingling on the skin, subjects will react after a certain amount of time after they get used to it. Subjects will react as if they're seeing something, all the way toward if you for example, immediately press some of those buttons on the back, people will lurch back as if there's something coming right at them, as if they've really seen something coming at them. These experiments are detailed in Daniel Dennett's book, Consciousness Explained, wonderful book. But the point again here is that with only a small amount of time, only a small amount of training, people will act as if things that are happening are real, when it's actually some other sense being generated or it's some part of the brain that is being triggered. As Marvin Minsky has a quote, which is that we have the sense of actuality when every question asked of our visual system is answered so swiftly that it seems as though those answers were already there. The speed of the system is very important and incredibly convincing. The illusion of reality depends on it. We want no latency. And that's how we measure sort of the gratifying power in some of today's systems. We want ISG, instant sensual gratification. And again, that is simply a function of power. It's just a function of money. I mean, you know, we'd all go buy those beautiful indigo boxes and have wonderful power at our fingertips. And people would have killed for the sort of stuff you have on your desk right now, just 10 or 15 years ago. So the sum of these things, put these four things together in your mind just for a moment. Number one, extremely high complexity, extremely high speed, interpolation of data, and the impossibility of really seriously ever debugging software, or not knowing if you've ever debugged it sufficiently, whatever that means. And you get the potential of civil liability. Things will go wrong. Now, one other thing that I'd like to touch on before I talk about precisely what can go wrong, give you some nice examples, is to just point out that old technology contains its own sort of safety net and seatbelt. To the extent it is visible, to the extent you have to play with it, to the extent you have to worry about interrupts, and to the extent you kind of can see the technology grinding away in front of you, to the extent you're in that Model T Ford, you've got your own seatbelt. You will be suspicious. You are not taking it for granted. You've got your eyes open, and you're watching the technology, at least out of the corner of your eye, maybe with your full attention. You're actually trying to get your work done and your stuff written or something of the sort. But you're aware of the technology grinding away in front of you. As the technology develops and as it gets integrated into our daily life, these checks and balances disappear. We maintain an independent sense at first whether something is right. For example, my wife totes up the checks on the electronic calculator, and then she checks it by hand to make sure that the calculator was right. And that's, you know, that's the first step. You have these parallel things. Well, I don't know if it works or not. You kind of go back and forth. And later on, we start taking it for granted to some extent. And then we lose the ability to cross-check at all. We completely are unable to determine whether or not something has gone wrong. And voicemail is sort of like that. And people just expect voicemail to work. And if it doesn't work, you know, they have a heart attack. They can't believe you didn't get the message or something like that. There's no backup. There's no contingency for technology not working. And that's your sign that technology is maturing. The problem is that in highly complex systems which have matured, there's no control group. There's nothing to measure the system by. You can't duplicate the results of the system. And maybe it's just practical. Maybe it's because of the amount of data you're dealing with. For example, in Washington, D.C., the data as to whether somebody's been arrested or not and should be held on bail and so on is in a machine. There is no conceivable way that the human beings on the payroll, the District of Columbia, can manually go through the data to check whether somebody has been previously convicted of murder. And there was a case. Somebody wants to go read it, I've got the site for you, but I promise no sites of a legal nature, where these guys were released. The machine didn't work too well. There's no backup. They assumed that guy had no record. He went out and he killed some more people. He'd already killed a bunch of people. Went and killed some more. Theoretically possible to cross-check that system, but practically impossible to cross-check that system. Now, in a sophisticated, high-speed, zero-interface VR environment, we simply will not know. We may not know when the system has crashed until it's too late to literally avoid injury and death. Now, when you realize that the real world's infrastructure is actually based on software, you know, the advancing nations and the developed nations fundamentally run on computers, they run on software, I think it's fair to say that there is a reasonable probability of injury when VR systems are used to control some of these programs. They computers become more reliable, then they become more integrated, and then when they fail spectacularly, with spectacular results. Recall the last Black Monday on Wall Street, where you had computer trading that was organized by computers. Computers were triggered to trade by and sell at specific times, and so you had a sort of a chain reaction, and caused Black Monday. I think the stock market lost a third of its value or something of the sort. I don't know if you're familiar with the SRI bugs list. I call it the bugs list. I've got the FTP address here if you want it. It's maintained by SRI down south of San Francisco. It's been going on for many, many years. It's very interesting. I have a copy of the complete printout here if somebody wants to have a look at it. And let me just tell you about some of the things that are on that bugs list. 3 bits of code brought down the East Coast phone service between June 26th and July 2nd, 1991. 1987, lethal doses of x-rays from a computer-controlled machine were generated. The glitch happened when commands were typed in too rapidly into the keyboard. People died. Army Black Hawk helicopters crashed. A couple of them crashed with loss of life. In the mid-1989s, the problem there was that EMF radiation was interfering with the unshielded connections. Can you believe this? Unshielded connections between the in-flight computer and the control surfaces. The confusing interface that was used for the missile systems on the Aegis cruise of the Vincennes contributed probably to the launch of the missile that shot down the Airbus Iran Flight 655. Recall there was a civilian plane brought down by a U.S. Missile some years ago. And the system was simply too complex for the trained personnel on the missile cruiser to handle in the amount of time that they had. Errors in modeling programs, either in the choice of the program or the manipulation of the program, have caused the collapse of buildings that were designed on the systems, Hartford Civic Center. The manufacturers of Sim Refinery, yes, the same company that makes SimCity, SimWorld, and so on, they were asked by Exxon or somebody like that to produce Sim Refinery. It cost the company about $10,000 to produce. It's a lovely training mechanism. And the people who wrote the program are very worried that if there's anything wrong with their program and people are going to be trained to do certain things, and that's the point of this program, it's kind of a virtual, almost virtual environment program to learn how to operate refineries, if people do what they're trained to do, that they're going to do something very bad with the actual refinery when they actually go online controlling the refinery. And if you apply that problem to a nuclear reactor facility, let's see what the problem is. 3 Mile Island, latest analysis of 3 Mile Island show that it came much, much closer to the meltdown than some people thought. There were a lot of problems there, not just computers. MUDs, 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 multi-user dungeons, just generate huge problems for systems administrators. They grab an enormous amount of computing power, and they cripple computer networks. And therefore, they are illegal in many campuses and in the entire continent of Australia. Illegal. Talk about what's legal or what's not legal. You know, let me count the ways. But MUDs are illegal in Australia. And that's just really low-intensity stuff compared to what is going to be available in about 10 or 15 years. Now, how do these issues get translated into the legal world? And I'm just going to finish up here. You know, if a bunch of lawyers here, I could start talking about, well, there are torts in these statutes here, and, you know, the Civil Code of Procedure, blah, 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 and so on, and give you cites and so on, and we could spend an enormous amount of time, and lawyers do spend an enormous amount of time, and they write in law journals about, is this kind of behavior cognizable under California's common law, blah, blah, blah. I mean, fundamentally, you know, all that's bullshit. I mean, none of that matters. The fact is that the law is incredibly flexible. Really ancient doctrines, 13th century stuff, 9th century stuff is used for easily, I mean simply without batting an eyelash for current problems. The point is that if anybody thinks they have been injured by what you do as a developer, as a user, as a systems administrator, or somebody who's involved in a virtual reality system because you designed it, because you're on it and you did something, if they think that they have been injured by you, they can sue you, and the law isn't going to worry a whole lot as to what kind of legal bed, Procrustean bed, that injury fits into. If there's been an injury, and you are probably responsible for it, you will get sued. And this is not beyond a reasonable doubt. The standards here, there are none, you've heard, there are no protections. You don't title to a lawyer, no warning. You don't have to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just 51%. 51. If the jury finds, just balance, 51%, you're probably liable. You lose the case. You lose the case, and there are no caps on the liability on you. It's not as if, you know, like a criminal statute says, fine, up to $10,000, jail, 5 years. That's wonderful. There are caps. You can sort of predict in advance a little bit. But in the criminal system, the sky's the limit. Punitive damages, billions of dollars if they want. Now, you may say, hey, why do I care? You know, I mean, I don't have any of that kind of money. That's a pretty good defense, actually. But in which case, I personally will not sue you. I will not waste my time doing that sort of thing. It costs $80 in California to sue somebody. It's really, really, really easy. $80, file the complaint, and boom, 5 years of nightmare has been imposed upon the other side. And in California, it is 5 long, bloody, horrible, nightmarish years. It's your worst nightmare. Goes much more slowly than a criminal situation. So the legal community is going to have, I think, a very serious interest in what the possibilities of error are in complex virtual reality systems. And really, you have two complex systems that are merging. You've got the virtual systems and the law. I think the system, the results will be unpredictable. Be willing to answer questions and so on later on at the appropriate time. Thanks very much.